I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Longtime conspiracy theorist and eight-time presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche has died. He was known for extremist views and outrageous claims, including one that Britain's Queen Elizabeth was a drug trafficker. Lyndon LaRouche was 96 years old.
And good riddance to him. This is J.G. Michael, and you're listening to Parallax Views. This is going to be a very sobering edition of the show, but not because of the death of Lyndon LaRouche, the fringe politician, convicted tax fraudster, and cult leader who passed away in February 2019. Rather, the heavy nature of this episode will spring from hearing the distressing testimony of someone who had their life altered in a terribly harrowing manner by LaRouche's so-called movement. Now, the popular image of the LaRouche movement, at least in the US, is that of a kooky political cult with a penchant for eccentric conspiracy theories concerning everything from Greek philosophy to Freudian psychoanalysis. They are perhaps most known here in the States for their street and college campus activism, attempting to convince anyone who would listen that Lyndon LaRouche was the one man who could save the world from a supposed oligarchic conspiracy involving Freemasonry, Zionism, and, perhaps most famously within LaRouchean lore, the British royal family, among others. This, combined with heavy doses of philosophically esoteric crackpottery, may explain why LaRouche and his followers have been the butt of many a joke in pop culture, including a throwaway reference on The Simpsons, of all places. Rest assured, however, the trail of damaged lives LaRouche has left in his wake paint a much more sinister picture. Joining the show to expose one such instance of this is Erica Duggan. In 2003, Erica's son, Jeremiah Duggan, was a young, vibrant British college student studying abroad with hopes, dreams, and, by all accounts, a bright future. Like many people his age, he also had become passionately concerned with the state of the world, particularly in light of the then-brewing Iraq War. Then, in an attempt to become involved with anti-war activism, he came in contact with the LaRouche movement. A few short months later, Jeremiah was dead in what German authorities declared a suicide. For 16 long years, Erica Duggan has contested that conclusion and sought justice for her late son. Fighting with both the LaRouche movement and German authorities in an attempt to find out what really happened to Jeremiah on that fatal night in March 2003. The conversation you're about to hear is her and Jeremiah's story. It is a troubling case that is increasingly relevant in an age of rising political extremism that has become ripe for the formation of abusive cults like that of the LaRouche organization. I'd like to thank Erica Duggan in advance for being willing to share this story with the Parallax Views audience, and particularly those listeners who may be unaware of the Jeremiah Duggan case here in the States. It is hard to imagine a mother's pain when losing her son at such an early age. As such, I highly encourage listeners to check out Erica's Justice for Jeremiah campaign and the LaRouche Danger website before, during, or after listening to this conversation. She deserves all of our support. May the truth set us free. Welcome to Parallax Views, Erica Duggan.
Hello.
So, Mrs. Duggan, I wanted to have you on the show because recently there's been news of the passing of this fringe political figure, Lyndon LaRouche, and a lot of the coverage around his passing has sort of painted him as just this kooky fringe political character, but really his movement, the LaRouche Youth Movement, has done a lot of damage to a lot of people. It's essentially a cult. But before we get into that, I want to talk about how you became aware of this movement, and that was through your son, Jeremiah. Tell me and my listeners who Jeremiah was. He seemed like a very bright, talented, and very principled young man.
Yes, he was. He was. He had lots of interests, and he had a dream that he wanted to study in Paris, like all the sort of great writers. And he was into poetry, and he thought he loved. He had wide interests, and he was studying in Paris, French, and he was also studying English at the Sorbonne because he loved learning. And he had a girlfriend who he was in love with, and he had everything before him. His life was just starting, really. He was also he was a very strong character as well, in that he would. He wouldn't mind speaking out for things. And there are many instances over his life when he showed that sort of strength of character. So there was no reason for me to think that he wouldn't be able to look after himself, really. And he was also very funny, he was always having a laugh. And some of his friends said you'd never were in his company for very long without, having a great joke about something. So it was... He wasn't the sort of person that one would imagine this would happen to. He was also, as I said, interested in many things, and he was very upset after the second 11. That's what I always say it the wrong way. The towers when they were the bombing in New York.
9/11.
That happened. Roughly when he went to Paris, and that sort of made a big impression on him. He was also very upset about the Iraq war, and he didn't think that Britain should be rushing in to go to war. He didn't know very much about political things, but he was idealistic, and I think he didn't believe in war, and he was kind of working for peace, and he felt very strongly about that. at the time when he bought the newspaper, and he first came under the influence of a LaRouche recruiter.
Well, if you could, so your son, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, he grows up in London, of course, and then goes to Paris for college, becomes involved with anti-war, and you mentioned a newspaper. I believe it was Nouvelle Solidarité.
Well, actually, he wasn't involved with them. That was the whole point. He wasn't involved politically. You know, he was studying very hard. But he didn't, and he certainly didn't know anything about Lyndon LaRouche, because he asked me to find out about him. And at the time, when I looked up, you know, being English, looked up on the internet, I couldn't find anything very much that made sense to me. And people in England at that time really didn't know. In America, perhaps you know about him, but here we don't. And he didn't have time to go to any of these meetings. And in fact, he was treated differently by the recruiter, so I believe, because they knew he was Jewish, so they didn't really include him straight away in coming to meetings. They kind of worked on him by himself. But because he didn't know about it, he wanted to protest against the Iraq war, he was sort of inveigled into going with them to find out more about this organization. And that's when he went to the conference that was held in Bad Schwalbach in Germany.
And that's that conference was held by, I believe, the Schiller Institute. If you could sort of tell my listeners, what is the Schiller Institute? I take it it's a front group for the LaRouche organization.
Yes, it's one and the same thing, because the head of the Schiller Institute is the head of the LaRouche organization, which is Lyndon LaRouche's wife, Helga Zepp LaRouche. But the Schiller Institute, which is how this particular organization works, they have, you know, they go in for poetry and music and the kind of cultural things. And that, of course, attracts many people who are unsuspecting that it's also a political organization, if it is, because I think it's really, the whole thing is more of an sort of intelligent gathering cult. But the Schiller Institute is really, you know, one and the same thing, and all headed by, was headed by Lyndon LaRouche, who's now dead, and that, of course, centered in America. But the major headquarters were in Wiesbaden in Germany for Europe.
And, of course, I guess your son probably picked up this New Solidarity newspaper. And a lot of these LaRouche papers and their pamphlets that they like to hand out, at first you wouldn't really recognize it for what it is. It just seems like a anti-war, you know, type stuff. So what happens when he comes in contact with these recruiters and goes to this conference?
Well, before he went, there was a recruiter in Paris who sort of fed him information and articles to read, which are very lots and lots of different names of unknown people. And at a superficial glance, it looks as if it's all very, clever. And I suppose a challenge to try and understand all the philosophy and economics and mixed up with math. And somehow it isn't clear, as you said, what's behind it all.
It comes off as very high-minded. I'm sorry to interrupt, but it comes off as very high-minded.
Yes, but I mean, if you look at it, I mean, if I looked at the kind of material that I found in his bags after he died, and you look at the kind of things that Lyndon LaRouche was saying, it's all based on conspiracy theories, and the baddies and all that is the British and the Jews. So that is the kind of fundamental basis of the whole thing, conspiracy theories and, you know, the scapegoating of the British and the Jews, and they're responsible for all the problems in the world sort of thing. And they have some fantastical notions. And one of those is very important, which is their idea about the Tavistock Clinic, which perhaps we'll talk about later because that is important. But, I mean, when he first saw this newspaper, and the recruiter sent him more information, There was a lot on Bush and Cheney and all that sort of thing, which he didn't know about, and suppose he was sort of soaking up and trying to understand in French, because Nouvelle Solidarité was in French.
So he ends up going to this conference. I believe it was called How to Reconstruct a Bankrupt World, which is interesting.
Yes.
Coming from such a bankrupt organization.
He's a fraudster. He was a convicted fraudster. So he's the last person in the world that should be giving advice to the world, but never mind.
Well, I'm just curious. I don't think anyone knows what exactly went on in this conference. I think it would reveal a lot if we did. But what do you think the picture is?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we do know because we've got his speeches. We've got a book which contains most of the speeches that in the bulletins that were found in my son's bags. There's kind of reports of what he was saying. And it is complicated conspiracy theories attributing, you know, as I said before, you know, all the troubles, everything was started. It was because of the sort of Queen of England and who's the Queen of the Jews and that sort of stuff. Anti-Semitic, anti-British conspiracy theories. I'm making it very simple, but it does come out as a sort of coded message. So you don't immediately recognize it if you don't know all these different names that he uses. And there's always a grain of truth in what he says, which is kind of overlaid with his own fantastical theories. And very often a person would focus on what actually appeals to you. And what you say, oh, yes, that could be right. And so you go along with it, and you're easily taken in. And that's why they use music and mathematics and exploring the Mars and that sort of thing, and laser weaponry and all these different ideas initially might appeal to somebody until, you know, but that isn't the only way that they draw people in, because I believe they have very destructive psychological methods of influence once they've got hold of you, like keeping you awake all night, overlading, too much information being given, and generally a certain process of making you feel responsible for all the problems of the world and working on you in a method that's quite common to all cults, the sort of breaking down of the person. And we know for a fact at that conference that there was quite a lot of, you know, violent methods of indoctrination which was going on from various recruiters and from their youth cadre, which was held after the conference. And we know that from some of the evidence that was given from people who were at the conference, who spoke about, you know, how Jeremiah was... And people there were, you know, subjected to extreme pressure and made to feel if they didn't give up their university courses and if they didn't devote themselves to becoming a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement, you know, they were like responsible for all the starving people in Africa. And, you know, that kind of approach, what are you doing? How can you justify studying at university when people are dying? And wars are being raged, you know, is that important? And also that apocalyptic view that if you don't join now, the world is going to, you know, Third World War is about to begin. The world is going to collapse. You know, there won't be a tomorrow. It's, you know, quarter to midnight. That sort of pressure is put on young people and put on people. And, of course, at that time, the atmosphere of the Iraq War, there were a lot of people that were very worried about the future, and especially young people. So once they have you in their grasp, it's difficult to leave, and I think that's what happened to my son.
Well, it seems like they go after these young kids with very good intentions who have very idealistic notions that I think are driven by a lot of principles that are very good. It sounds like your son was very concerned about things like the Iraq War. And it sounds like the LaRouche movement, what they do is they take that and they take advantage of it
Absolutely.
What's interesting to me is, would you say that the characterization of this movement as sort of telling these kids that Lyndon LaRouche was like the savior figure and he's the only one that can stop all of this, is that
absolutely
an exaggeration or is that true?
Not really, because they wanted, he stood for president. They thought he could save the world. That was the key, that, you know, join the movement because there's only one person in the world who can save the world, and that's Lyndon LaRouche. And how many times did he stand for president? And the ridiculous thing about it was that it can't have been a real political party because they never really had any representation, even though all over in different countries of the world, they've got different political parties with different names, Nouvelle Solidarité in France, Citizens Electoral Role in Australia, and Bouzo in Germany. They've never had any success. And when these members have tried to push and perhaps joined up with others, and they've been stopped because they don't, you know, it's not really about political achievement. It's actually about raising money, getting rich, being in the power of the political leader. But all that leaves aside the manipulation, which is also the key to how these kind of political cults work, and this one works. They have this fantastical idea about the Tavistock Clinic, which is very, very important, which I've realized, looking back on things, was key if you want to understand what happened to Jeremiah in the end.
Well, I think we'll get to that, but real quick, I've read that, so after the conference, I believe Jeremiah ends up going to, I guess they're these youth cadre schools.
Yes.
That, the LaRouche Youth Movement sets up. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about what happens when Jeremiah goes there?
Well, what happens is, well, they're trying to recruit people at this conference. So they've always got some goal. They get the young people to come to the cadre school. When they come to the cadre school, they start saying, you must stay on. We must go and protest in Berlin. And, you know, it's a method of gripping them. So they had lectures. Lyndon LaRouche spoke. Helga LaRouche spoke. Jonathan Tannenbaum spoke. And they all, you know, tried to tell, and they also had chanting and singing, you know, and stayed up late. So there was all this influencing. And from we've got various witnesses who were there and described it. You know, many of the young people were very upset. There was one person who really was weeping and rushed out because they were discussing painting or something and they had different views. It's all about manipulating and changing people and controlling them. And so during the cadre school, they're desperately trying all their methods of indoctrination to recruit and being exposed to these kind of pressures. That's what goes on at these schools, which I think is very dangerous because there's no monitoring of what they're actually doing. And they are schools. Also, they're schools in warfare. They make them think about themselves as soldiers.
Right, foot soldiers for LaRouche and his sort of
yes,
you know, twisted view of the world. Yeah.
Yes. And one of the things is cut off from your university, nothing, you know, break from your family, break from the people you know, even if you had a girlfriend, break from them because you now are the servant of this organization. And it's all about isolation, too.
So I'm assuming LaRouche benefits from all this. He's sort of getting these people to work for him as sort
idea
of slaves and making tons of money off of it.
Well, at that time, which was, you know, you must remember, 2003, this was the time of the Iraq War, he had this idea of all the old people in his organization where they were out of it. He didn't want too much. He wanted to lay them off because they would probably cost him money and pensions. And he wanted to build up a big, you know, lots and lots of the youth movement. It was fairly new in Europe. I think in America it's probably been going for a few years, but he was trying to make a bigger and bigger youth movement. And, you know, those people could be on the phones begging money from people and getting their whoever they knew to donate more money, and they'd be more useful to him. So that's what's happening. But, of course, I don't know in America so much, but certainly the exposure after my son's death of what they really were about has possibly hit them, and their numbers might have dropped off quite considerably in expanding the youth movement.
So When Jeremiah is at these youth schools that they're running, I believe this is where he first really runs into some of the really scary stuff, because of course Jeremiah is both British and Jewish.
Yeah.
So they became very aware of that very quickly. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about what happens with that and sort of the blowback he got from these people?
Well, and I'm trying to keep to the evidence that we have, and we have evidence that Jeremiah, when he heard them saying that the Jews, you know, were responsible actually for the Iraq war, and in fact all the troubles and problems in the world, he spoke up and said, "But I'm a Jew," and that of course was kind of, you know, and also they spoke about the Tavistock. And he said to a friend, you know, it's rubbish about the Tavistock, what they're saying. So he voiced his, you know, he didn't really want to join. That we were told too by the manager. He didn't want to join because he told this particular witness, he said, there's something strange about this organization. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I'm going to find out. And he wasn't going along with them, and he wanted to leave. And of course, I know for a fact, because 25 minutes before his dead body was found, he rang me, and he told me that, you know, he was in big trouble, and he wanted to get away from these people, and he named the organization. So it's quite clear that when they were talking about the Tavistock and breeding assassins and many of their ideas, that he realized that, you know, he needed to find out more about it. He didn't trust them. And he kept saying, "I don't trust LaRouche." This was the thing he was repeating. And of course, that was a dangerous thing to say.
Well, it's been reported that Jonathan Tenenbaum, who you mentioned earlier, actually, and you can clear this up if it's not true, but he told you, according to a report that I read, that when all these claims about you know, the Jews started the Iraq war, that Jeremiah stood up and said, "But I'm a Jew." Is that
Yes, he did. He told me that. I was trying to understand what could have, because we were told by the police he'd committed suicide. And of course, I was trying to make sense of all this. How can this all be? What was going on? Why did he phone me in such distress? And when I was trying to find this out, Jonathan Tenenbaum told me the story, and as soon as he told me that he'd spoken up and said, "But I'm a Jew," I suddenly realized what could have caused him to be so upset. Because if you come from a family, like his grandfather was a Holocaust survivor, and you find yourself in Germany, and you're with a whole lot of people who are saying anti-Semitic things, he would have sensed it, he knew it. And that's a very frightening thing to find yourself amongst such people suddenly, who you thought were going to sort of idealistically save the world. Suddenly they've become, you know, anti-Semitic.
Right, the mask sort of comes off, and you
yes.
see these people for what they really are. They're these horrible, rabid anti-British anti-Semites.
And that's frightening. That must have frightened him. And at the same time, he had still been subjected to the kind of brainwashing as, you know, you must do something, you must be responsible, the world's going to be at war. So a little bit of that brainwashing would still be putting him in a very tender state, as well as which he probably hadn't slept for a couple of nights.
Well, I think it's interesting because you mentioned the Tavistock Institute, and, you know, the LaRouche movement claims that Tavistock is a brainwashing center, which is, you know, to me, that's really projection on their part. LaRouche seems like a brainwashing center in a way.
Yes.
But
They are, whatever they say, it's them. So they're like the anti-fascist fascists. And this Tavistock thing, I didn't realize how important it was in the beginning, because right in the very beginning, the day we went to Germany after his death, the next day, the police said, "Oh, we were told that, you know, Jeremiah was in the Tavistock clinic," and we didn't know what are they talking about. And then when we met the manageress of the Schiller Institute and Jonathan Tenenbaum, all they could say was, I believe he was at the Tavistock. He was at the Tavistock. And then in the end, his father said, forget the Tavistock, because we thought it was irrelevant. But later, we found out that they had this theory that the Tavistock breeds assassins and that they go all over the world killing important political leaders. We've also found out from a witness, and all this has been presented in a court, so it's evidence, that a few hours after Jeremiah's death, Helga Zepp-LaRouche actually said, you know, Jeremiah was sent, was in the Tavistock, and he was probably an enemy sent over, you know, to harm our organization. And recently we've had experts who presented information saying that Jeremiah was seen as dangerous to them because he was a Jew, because he was British, and because he knew about the Tavistock. He'd actually been there. His school was very near there. And
I was going to say real quick. So your son was at the Tavistock clinic, I believe, for counseling.
Yes, when we got divorced. Yes, it's a counseling clinic. Yeah.
Okay. Because I have a lot of American listeners that may be unfamiliar with what Tavistock is. So I don't know if you could briefly just maybe fill my listeners in.
Yes, the Tavistock is quite a famous clinic in North London. And Freud had a lot to do with the start of it, because it initially started the whole idea of psychotherapy and counseling. And I could explain to you also that they played a part. I believe some of the people were involved in trying to help the Nazi prisoners of war, you know, become more democratic. But whether that's why Lyndon LaRouche got in, you know, had this idea of the Tavistock. But it is a fantasy, a sort of fantastical fantasy, because they were paranoid, and we've got evidence of that, that they always thought that people were trying to kill them. LaRouche thought that, and so did Helga Zepp-LaRouche, that they had this paranoia about, you know, people trying to kill them.
It's also interesting because you mentioned the whole anti-fascist thing. It seems like the LaRouche movement overall sort of initially likes to paint themselves as sort of almost like left wing, you know, they're fans of, you know, FDR, and I think LaRouche ran as a Democrat multiple times, but all the research I've seen is that they are a far right wing fascist movement.
They are, and that's the sad thing. Many of the idealistic young people who join, it's like the absolute opposite of their ideals, and his power is, what he writes about in his manual for recruitment, which is called Beyond Psychoanalysis. Notice the title, Beyond Psychoanalysis.
I was going to say, it's interesting with the psychoanalysis bit, because, of course, Freud was Jewish. So, of course, LaRouche would go after psychoanalysis.
Yes, but his power is if he can turn somebody around, if he can make somebody who believes in something and change them and manipulate them so they can believe in the opposite. He's in their power. He can make them do anything. He can make them never speak to their parents again, or not speak to their parents for a year to punish them if for some reason they do something that they don't like. You know, it's power over people. And Helga Zepp-LaRouche never had any children, but she's stolen the lives of many, many children and young people over the years. And there have been many other deaths as well. I wouldn't say death through murder, but self-induced suicide from their methods, their dangerous, destructive methods. And my son died, and we don't know exactly the circumstances surrounding his death, but we do know that he had no intention of going to Germany to commit suicide or die.
Well, you know, so obviously this paranoid LaRouche group is paranoid because your son was British Jewish and also was at the Tavistock clinic, so they're thinking he's like some enemy sent to get them. Or
absolutely, he was seen as the enemy even before he went to that conference. I believe that he was singled out, and so I'm very suspicious that something happened that night, And perhaps they were trying to find out, you know, deprogram him or find out his relation to the Tavistock. And something terrible happened to him that night when he died. And this led to his death, and that I'm sure of. And I think it must have been to do with him being seen as the enemy. That would be the motivation.
Well, so he's in Germany then, and I guess he is staying with one of the people from the Schiller Institute, right? The night when all of this happens.
He was staying with the editor of the EIR magazine.
Executive Intelligence Review, right?
Yeah, the Executive Intelligence Review. Yes, and that's a very, very important person, you know, who's in the organization.
And
well, so we believe he, but whether he was there on that last night has never been properly investigated.
Well, things obviously get really tense that night, and I don't know if you're comfortable talking about it, but there were two phone calls. I believe one with Jeremiah's girlfriend Maya, and then
yes.
The phone call with you. Are you comfortable talking about those two
yes.
phone calls and what was said
yes.
in them?
Yes, I am, because I feel it's very important for exposure of the danger of this organization, because the more that's known, the less likelihood there is of other young people ever being drawn into this organization and suffering, and their families suffering.
So that first phone call was with his then girlfriend, Maya. Could you tell my listeners just a little bit about that phone call? It seems like it was very, very nervous and tense. Jeremiah was talking about very vague conspiratorial things. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, she made a statement in which she describes what she remembers about the phone call, but she said she knew immediately when she spoke to him, that he had to come back to Paris. And he told her that he was coming back to Paris. He also told her that he'd found out something very important, and it was so important he couldn't tell her on the phone, but he'd tell her when he got back. And he spoke, you know, about laser weaponry, I think, and things like that.
And human experiments, right?
Yes. And so obviously we're not quite sure what all that was behind that.
But it's stuff that the LaRouche movement sort of tries to indoctrinate people with, I assume.
Yeah, so possibly he'd been told all sorts of way-out fantasies, and whether that was what he wanted to speak about, we'll never really know.
So, obviously, Maya is very concerned about him, knowing that he needs to come back to Paris, something needs to give. And then, of course, there's that final phone call with you. If you could speak to that, because it's a very chilling thing to read about, actually.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm haunted by it. But it was quite plain from, you know, the very first thing he said was that he was, you know, he was in big trouble. So, you know, to suddenly get the phone call in the early hours of the morning, and the very first words that he said, and he sounded terrified, was that he was in big trouble. There was something terribly wrong. And he named this organization. He said he wanted to get away from them. He said, you know these people, Nouvelle Solidarity. So he used the French movement's title to describe these people. And then somehow there was somebody else with him at the time trying to stop him speaking, because I heard him, you know, say, no, let me speak, let me speak. And then the phone was cut. And he said straight away, I'm frightened. And he sounded in terror. And from what I, you know, I remember, that he then, you know, he kind of said in a different kind of voice that I had to come that moment to him and rescue him. You know, I want to see you now. And it was like a tremendous cry for help, as if that moment his life was in danger. And of course, I said, well, where are you? And he, before I said that, I actually was so alarmed by the tone of his voice and the appeal for me to come and help him that I found myself saying, I love you. Like, I was trying to keep him calm. And that kind of comes out, like, I don't know why I suddenly said that, but I think it must have been because I was so feared for him. And when he was spelling where he was, at that point, in the middle of the word, W-I-E-S, the phone was cut. And of course, being cut off from him like that and never seeing him alive again, you know, is a very terrible, terrible thing to be left with. And after, and therefore, for it's led me to try for 16 years to try to go to him in a sense, help him in whatever situation he was in, because you've been asked to do something and I can't do it till I know what was happening to him. What was this danger he faced? What happened to him? Who was hurting him? And that was the phone call that sort of has haunted me for the last 16 years.
Well, I'm glad you've been willing to talk about that phone call. I assume that it can be hard to talk about. I want to know, though, what happens after that phone call, just for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with the case. I'm sorry if I'm making you relive this. I apologize.
No. Well, of course, as soon as I got that phone call, the first thing I think I did, looking at my phone records, was I used my mobile phone. I didn't want to use the ordinary phone because I was hoping he'd ring back again. And I tried to phone his father. Because I was in a bit of a state myself, I rang where he used to live, and then I rang where he was now living with his partner, and because we're divorced, and then after that, you know, according to my phone records, because I mean I was in such a state then, my mother was sick, had heard the phone call as well, and she said, well, you know, what you're going to do. And I then rang up the police. We have 999. And I kept ringing, and I got through to Scotland Yard, and I was begging them to help me, but nobody would give me any help. And they all just said, we have nothing to do with Germany. So it was an awful, awful thing.
And then I guess the official verdict, what happened was... The death was ruled a suicide, right?
Yes, because the next day when we went over to Germany, the inspector Schecher sat opposite us with this thin file, and he said, this is a definite case, an open and shut case of suicide. We don't have to investigate. And no matter what we said, we don't have to have a post-mortem. We don't have to do anything. It's a clear case of suicide. He was run over by a series of cars, and that was closed. There was definitely not going to do another thing, although we begged them to. And then with time, we found out that there'd been no proper witness statements, there'd been no examination by any doctor of his injuries. So much evidence had been destroyed. We asked for his clothes and shoes. That was also destroyed. So the door was shut from day one, and my lawyers will back that up. And so, you know, various things, legal action has been taken for 16 years, you know, to try and get it open. And, of course, we did eventually get it open in 2012.
Well, it sounds like, so he's hit by these cars. It sounds like he was running from... something.
Well, there's a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, at the second British inquest, we had evidence to say that he was never run over by those cars. We had experts to say, if you're run over by cars, you know, you have tire marks on a body, and we've got photographs of his body, and there's nothing. And there was no forensic, what's the word? There was nothing. I've gotten the word now. But there was nothing on the cars. There was no blood. There was no cloth. There was nothing to show that he'd actually been hit by those cars. And even in subsequent investigations that happened after 2012, the person who's supposed to have run over him never answered the question, did she run over him? She was never interviewed properly either. So there's unanswered questions about the crash. But leave that aside, because that does seem strange. There's unanswered questions about where he was shortly before his death and who he was with. All that is still to be properly investigated.
And I believe one of the coroners involved with the case William Dolman, who's very, I guess, well-known in Britain. He's the only coroner to have been a regular BBC broadcaster. He was involved in the case, and I believe he very much said that it wasn't a suicide, correct?
Yes, he said, there was no information, really. It was very little information. I mean, remember, the passport wasn't even with his body. Not with his body. The passport was with somebody else, was in the hands of the manageress of the Schiller Institute, which, why was it with them and not with his things? And so he said there was no information, and he discounted suicide. That was the first inquest.
And I believe also that, when the case was sort of reinvestigated, one of the coroners sort of said they ruled that it was an accident, but that it wasn't a suicide, that there was evidence of an altercation beforehand.
Yes. Yes, they looked into the details of the injuries that he had. He had certain injuries of his hand, which could only be caused by him putting them up against his head. And he looked at the case and he made that statement that there was a signs that there might have been an altercation or fight, I suppose, prior to his death. He did state that. But I must say that I was not at all happy with the second inquest, and that was because 3 days before the inquest, after many attempts to get information from the German authorities, a sort of patched-up document in German arrived at the court, which wasn't properly translated, which basically defended the first inspector for making an assumption of suicide. And, it contained inaccurate information, saying things like there were witnesses to the crash, there never were any witnesses. So I was very unhappy about this information that at the last minute was given to the court in German, because I was never given the chance to refute that. The coroner said, whatever the German police say, I accept. If police tell me something, I accept it. So to me, it was a flawed investigation inquest in that sense. But the only thing they did definitely come out with was that it was not suicide.
You know, one of the oddest things to come out of this is, I find it amazing that this LaRouche movement comes out and says that, this case of Jeremiah Duggan, it's just to smear Lyndon LaRouche. This is all part of the conspiracy. Blair and Bush are going after us. And meanwhile, you...
I know nothing about Blair and Bush. I've never spoken to them in my life.
Well, I think we know that. But what I find fascinating about it is that you are actually the one going up against the system. Not only are you fighting with this LaRouche movement and, speaking out against them, but you're also taking on the German authorities and British authorities who have bungled this entire case.
Well, exactly. I'm absolutely shocked and horrified to think, even when we had a very excellent verdict from a high Frankfurt court, which said that it was a great mistake of the authorities not to investigate, that my son could not possibly have run this distance from the flat in Wiesbaden to the place where his body was found, and his body was found very near to their offices, and they examined that. And many things that they said, including you must investigate the possibility of collective harming, which means, corporate responsibility, kind of a cult influencing, having part to play in something happened. And, the German authorities, the prosecutor in Wiesbaden, have never changed. They've never changed from 16 years when we had Inspector Schacher, who, as far as I'm concerned, pretended he was a doctor and gave a report of injuries, took off my son's clothes, destroyed the clothes, all that. They've never changed. They brought the same inspector back, in 2012 to carry on the same investigation, to cover his own mistakes. And they've never once interviewed the named suspect, the bodyguard of Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who was supposed to have who spoke about my son being attacked. There have been witnesses that we've gathered evidence and who've made statements saying that my son was beaten, attacked. And yet those people, there's never been a proper investigation. They just ask people questions, and if there's any leads, they don't take them up. They've treated my lawyers very badly. Normally you speak to them. They've never interviewed me officially. And in every way, they seem to side with the LaRouche organization.
That's what I was sort of getting at. It sounds like they're siding with them.
Yeah, they see me as the enemy. I'm seen as the enemy. I should be helped. I should have been helped in the beginning by the LaRouche organization if they were decent. They should have said to me, now let's see what happened. Let's examine our practices. We're a school. We take on responsibility for the care, duty of care to young people. Let's find out what went wrong. Your son, you know, what happened to him? No, they refused. They refused to let me speak to the last people who were with him. They told me lies about he was staying with somebody who had nothing to do with our organization. And then they started writing theories about me. I can't accept the death of my son, so I'm blaming it on them. Why should I do that? But the LaRouche organization have turned me into the enemy. And in the same way, the prosecutor service in Wiesbaden, instead of taking seriously the threat to human life of this youth movement and to other lives, instead of investigating that to find out what the danger is, they've brushed it under the carpet, and they've allowed Lyndon LaRouche, a convicted felon, to regularly come over to Germany and do more indoctrination from people attracted from all over the world to find out more and spread the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from Germany. That's absolutely shameful in my eyes.
Well, that's what confuses me about it. I've always thought that Germany, took a very hard stance against right-wing extremism, given, you know, the history of what happened in World War II, but it seems like they are taking the side of the LaRouche movement.
Well, the prosecutor in Wiesbaden certainly are, but not the higher Frankfurt court. So I wouldn't condemn the whole justice system of Germany. I believe there are some very, very good judicial officers and probably very good police officers in Germany, but there are also some that are not good. And it appears to me that there's something institutionally wrong with that office that don't want to do a proper job of investigation. And it could be to do with the fact that they don't want it publicized that a young British Jew is a visitor to Germany, and within a few days he's dead. And perhaps it's something to do with they can't face looking into the fact that they've allowed this kind of youth movement and organization to flourish. And perhaps it's to do with they've actually used them, because they do make themselves safe. They operate as an intelligence.
They're a private intelligence organization.
Yes, so perhaps it's useful to them to have, I don't know what the links exactly are, that's yet to be uncovered, but the police and the EIR, I'm only saying about specific older members, of course. I doubt if the younger recruits know anything about this, but Helga and Lyndon, and their security, remember they always have their security, what some of those officers, Hellenbroch and people like that, what their links are, people, what their links are with the sort of intelligence, perhaps has protected them. I cannot explain it in any other way.
Well, I'm curious. News broke, I guess. Initially, I believe it broke on February 12th, and then a day or two later, it came out that Lyndon LaRouche had passed away this year at the age of 96. How did you first come across the news, and what was your initial reaction to it?
I noticed that he'd been very quiet for 2 years, and I read a book by Matthew Sweet saying that he'd been living in Germany for 2 years. I thought to myself, and then I heard on the news that he died. I think Helga Zepp-LaRouche. At first, I didn't want to believe anything because the cults can make up anything. but then Helga Zetlerusch made a statement that he died. There's been very little information about, you know, his funeral or what happened, or which is also very fishy, but represents that somebody who you know nothing about his funeral, you know nothing about what happened to him, how he was remembered in that sense by the organization, shows you, the only sort of makes you think, well, what are they scared of now, you know, that there's so many people that want to have vengeance on him or something, I don't know. But I felt a great relief when I heard that he died, because I felt that there's so many families whose lives have been scarred by his work, and that his work must not go on, because his work has sowed the seeds of hatred all over the world, and that it is a good thing that that does not continue. That's how I felt.
Well, you know, it gets into, a lot of the coverage here in the U.S. has sort of painted LaRouche as just this kooky charlatan that was convicted of tax fraud. But I think your story, as well as many others, show that the LaRouche movement is, as you've put it, a danger. It is a real dangerous movement. Could you talk about some of the testimonials from others that you have worked with regards to exposing the LaRouche movement and just how dangerous it really is?
Well, yes. I mean, there are people in America who've, if you look on the website, Justice for Jeremiah, and also LaRouche-danger.org, there's family testimonies of how their families have been scarred and how they feel they've lost their sons and daughters. And of course, you know, they're damaged by, their lives are wasted, and perhaps after 20 years they might leave the organization, and then they're left. Their studies were interrupted. They've never made the most of their lives. And I think they end up being very unhappy people. But the families themselves, there have been many divorces through this organization. There have been abortions and children that have never been born or never had, because he had forced abortions at one stage.
My God.
Because he wanted them to work, you know, for the organization. Although he was against abortion, he actually forced abortion. So there's documentation on that. But I think I have been contacted by many families who think that by speaking to me, they'll learn something. And also they sometimes bring me together with their sons and daughters who are members, because they want me to tell them about my son and that, you know, what sort of person he was. And he was just an ordinary student, and then he died, because the LaRouche organization are making me into some sort of enemy that works for Bush and Blair. You know, they're winding me into their conspiracy theories, and they want me to tell their sons and daughters, you know, the truth. But I find when I speak to them, it's very difficult, as if the brainwashing is very extreme, and they cannot easily change their mind once they've been drawn into the organization. And I see also that for the families, it's almost like a death. They've got a son, and now they're a daughter, and they're part of the organization, but they're a changed person, and they feel they've lost them. And although they might not have died like my son, it's like they're living with a living death. And I feel terribly, terribly sad when I'm in the presence of these mothers and fathers, many, very few of whom can speak out, because if they speak out, their children will never speak to them again. So there's a very rare one or two parents who do speak out, who then are alienated even further from their children. And it's very sad. It's killed many mothers and fathers. I know that. It's led them to a very sad end in their own lives. And I find that terribly upsetting, because it's like unheard voices and unheard stories.
Well, I mean, just what they do to these kids, it sounds like they intimidate them, you know, just with what I would just call psychological terrorism, you know, to
yes.
cut themselves off from their families and their loved ones and their friends. I mean, it's...
And their education as well, the opportunities to develop themselves. Wasted their lives. And yes, I mean, I've spoken a lot to ex-members, and they have a very difficult time.
Well, you also have a section of the website LaRouche Danger that's dedicated to, you know, a lot of people think, you know, that the LaRouche movement are just these people in various odd parts of America that hand out these little pamphlets, you know, that promote wacky conspiracy theories. But this is actually a global movement, as we've learned from Jeremiah's case, and it's all over the world. Could you talk
yes.
a little bit about that?
Well, on LaRouche-danger.org, there's a section which is LaRouche's influence all over the world, and we've listed all the countries. And if anybody sends us anything, I mean, it's not highly organized, it's just bits of information which shows you that there are members in these different places or cells, and, you know, they make their presence known, they make their ideas known, and it is very widespread. We know it's in Canada as well. So although they might not be a large number of people, only might be a small group, it's still a very pernicious spreading of dangerous anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which spreads.
Yeah, it's like a virus, this ideology that they have.
Yes, and it feeds into other viruses that are being spread on the internet, of course.
Well, I'm curious now with the passing of Lyndon LaRouche, you know, and I'm not a religious person myself, but if there is a hell, I assume LaRouche is there. What though? Do you think it's going to come of this? I've heard rumors that a lot of members are probably going to break off now that they've been waiting for this moment. Do you think this will be the death knell of the LaRouche movement?
Well, now Helga Zepp LaRouche, you know, is kind of the strong force, especially in Germany. I don't know what power she has in America. I know that many people who've worked with her have ended up saying she's paranoid, she's imagining that people are going to kill her all the time. And she eventually seems to have fallen out with many of the important previous leaders. So there must be something in her. And I've heard stories, you know, about that. So I don't know if her speeches have the charisma, because he is he's a very rhetorical speaker. And, of course, that will be gone because he's dead. But these kind of organizations, you know, whether they'll peter out or whether they'll turn into something else. What interests me most of all, I think, is that there are people that are probably still retired and receiving some payment from the LaRouche organization, I don't know, who don't speak out. And I'm hoping that after his death, many more will not be cowards, but will be brave and honorable and true to their better selves and speak out. And let us know what really went on, and especially in the case of my son, because I know there are people who have information who still haven't spoken, who are silent. And that's, to me, the most important thing for people, parents and ex-members and members, to speak out and tell the truth, because that's the only way we can ever sort of move into a better living with each other. And I'm hoping that more, and already something has actually come. I can't speak about it yet because it's, you know, my lawyers have only just got getting this new information, but there has been new information to do with how Jeremiah was seen as the enemy. And I think that one thing will lead to another, and we might find out some of the answers to the questions that have never been solved, like where he was, who he was with, and what happened to him. I've gone off the subject a bit, but that's what the legacy that I hope will come out of his death, that people will turn around and be their better selves.
Well, I guess my last question to you then is, are you hopeful that, you know, your son, Jeremiah, as well as all the other victims of this, it's just a cult at the end of the day. I won't even call it a political organization. Do you think that they will receive justice eventually?
Well, justice comes in different forms. Justice comes if we know the truth. For me, to know the truth is very important. because I'm let, you know, it's terrible not to know what happened to him. And I think that we will never, you know, we will never stop asking these questions and working through the law, because we haven't got anything else. The law is all we have. And it's important that that we do know, you know, what happened to him. And I want that very much. Whether they have to be, you know, of course I would like them tried in a court of law, because we must outlaw what is dangerous. I'm not one for great punishment and sending people behind bars, but I'm much more, you know, sort of the truth and reconciliation idea of tell the truth and tell the story and let us know, because that in itself, to me, is the most important thing. But I don't know if I'll ever, you know, if this will ever happen. It depends now that LaRouche is dead, on people being brave enough to speak out.
Well, I certainly hope that justice for Jeremiah will, you know, come about. How can my listeners support your work, the Justice for Jeremiah campaign, and also the LaRouche Danger website? How can they reach out if they have information? Just anything about your work and how they can get involved.
Well, if they go to the website, Justice for Jeremiah, all one word, or LaRouche Danger.org, there's an email address there, and they can write to me, and they can see, you know, if there's any information they've got. They could always go to, they could write to me directly, or they could, as it has happened, witnesses have gone to lawyers and made statements anonymously, and some witnessed, and that information can then be passed on through lawyers, if they want to be anonymous, to me or to my lawyer. And all that information is on those websites. But if anybody does know anything, I would, you know, be able to sleep more at night if I do know really what happened to him in the end. Of course, if anybody wants to support my legal campaign, because, you know, it has cost a little bit, I'd be glad. But the most important thing is the information, I think.
Well, Erica Duggan, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views and just sharing your and Jeremiah's story. I think, you know, the truth will set us free and the truth will come out.
I believe so, yes. And also the authorities have to take note of the court's verdict, which up to now they've used to justify their own mistakes or their own failure to investigate. So the legal system in Germany, I hope, you know, will follow a path of justice. And thank you for having me on the program.
That does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Normally, I would promote the Parallax Views Patreon page at the end of the episode. I'm not going to do that this time. Please go and support Erica Duggan and the Justice for Jeremiah campaign. Please look at the LaRoucheDanger.org website as well. Erica deserves all the support we can give her. I'm at a loss for words. What we've talked about in this episode is just it's a travesty of justice, and I can't say much more. So if you can donate to Erica or do anything to help the cause for justice for Jeremiah, please do so. Like I said, that's all I can say at the end of this episode. And with that being said, good riddance to Lyndon LaRouche. Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing this like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.